Hey guys, let me tell you about the sponsor for today's episode. Podcorn is a marketplace connecting podcasters to amazing podcast opportunities, such as the one I'm doing right now. They have host read ads, interview segments, and more. The great thing about Podcorn is there is no middleman. Podcasters of all sizes can browse and pick opportunities right on the platform. You set your own rates and you collaborate with brands directly. The best thing is that you never give up any rights to your podcast, and Podcorn will support you every step of the way to ensure that you are protected and compensated for the work you do. Click the link on my show notes page to sign up to Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities today.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Morswick.
I'm happy to say we've got Scott Horton on the line. As you know, Scott is the author of three fantastic books: Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, and The Great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Show Interviews, 2004 through 2019. He's also the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of Antiwar.com, and the host of Antiwar Radio for Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, as well as the Scott Horton Show podcast. Please check out the show notes for links to Scott's books on Amazon. So, Scott, how are you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Hanging in there, hanging in there. Thank God it's a new year, I guess. Hopefully it'll be different. But just wanted to talk to you a little bit about Afghanistan. Now that the dust has had a chance to settle on all that stuff going on there. So let's kind of go back, I guess, to the start of the war. Was that thing ever winnable? And if there was a chance that it was winnable, then what went wrong?
No, it was not winnable. What went wrong was that they decided to do a regime change in that country and try to create a new government there. And once they decided to do that, that meant then they made enemies out of that new government's enemies and, you know, allies out of its friends, and then enemies out of their enemies too. And essentially what it was, to boil it down, you know, it's oversimplified, but it's also true, that America and the NATO allies too, we're essentially trying to foist a coalition government of approximately 20% minority groups, the Tajiks, Hazaras, and the Uzbeks, about 20% each, adding up to about 60%, onto the plurality population of the country, the ethnic Pashtuns. Mm-hmm. And so there is no single majority ethnicity there, but the single largest one is still just a plurality, but they were on the outs. And this is a warrior culture, an ancient tribal warrior culture, and they're armed with, you know, 20th century weapons anyway. Mm-hmm. And if you just pull up a map, and this is why I got this right as a cab driver in the year 2001, is you can just look at a map and see Afghanistan is the size of Texas. Yes. And it's landlocked away from the Indian Ocean, not just behind Pakistan and Iran, where you can't get to it through Iran, obviously, but there's a massive mountain range on the Pakistan-Afghan border all the way up. So you have to take a highway, approximately, I think it's 400 miles, 500 miles, to get up to the Khyber Pass from the port of Karachi before you can even take a left and get into Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So by the time a gallon of fuel gets to our guys at their firebase, it's $400 a gallon, because they have to pay the Taliban protection money to protect the convoy to deliver the fuel to the guys at the firebase, who, of course, then are extremely limited in their range, this kind of thing. So in other words, like I called the book, it's a fool's errand. In fact, that title comes from, it was my question to Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, who was U.S. Army in, he was actually a veteran of Iraq War I and Iraq War II. And then in Afghanistan, he had a unique job as a resupply, kind of a crack team of resupply supervisor that would go around arming all different branches too. but just making sure that everybody had enough ammo and enough boots and enough whatever weapons that they needed for the terrain and whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And so he had a chance to go all around the country, all different parts of the war, all different theaters of the war. And this is in 2010, 11, 12, during and toward the end of the Obama, David Petraeus surge there. Yeah. And then he broke ranks and told the truth, wrote a letter, did an interview with the Washington Post and went to the Congress and blew the whistle and said that David Petraeus is just lying and saying that any of this has achieved anything at all, just can't work. And he was a famous whistleblower from that time. And I interviewed him and, you know, he's a serious guy. He's a lieutenant colonel. He's a very serious, professional warrior, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, well, listen, and again, experienced with a wide experience all across different areas of Afghanistan, et cetera. And I asked him, okay, but what if you had a much more competent general than David Petraeus, who obviously is good only at public relations, but doesn't know the first thing about winning a war. But what if you had a good general? And what if you had 500,000 men, the entire army active force, had nothing else to do but go and remake Afghanistan to be, to create the end result the State Department promised us, a regular, essentially parliamentary democracy with Western norms and a rule of law and an independent judiciary and a pro-American foreign policy. And then and I said, would that have worked then? And what if I gave you 10 more years or 20? How about that? Or would it still just be a fool's errand? And he said, it's still just a fool's errand because the more you escalate, the more they hate you and want you out. There is no equation for a counterinsurgency campaign that doesn't equal the foreigner losing and being forced out. I mean, imagine a foreign army, even with the, let's say our politicians were just so weak somehow they couldn't withstand an invading army. What would the American people do about an invading army on our shores? We would shoot them all until they died. We would not tolerate that ever, no matter what. Like, the famous fantasy movie. It's a great movie. It's a fun, brilliant, hilarious, wonderful movie, Red Dawn, the original Red Dawn from the 80s. That's of course what the boys would do. Jump in their trucks with their rifles and shoot the bad guys until they disappeared. And in this case, we're the invaders and they're the Wolverines.
I'm old enough. I saw that in the theater and it was a great film. And that's what we all dreamt of, back in the 80s. Bring it. And we're all going to get in pickup trucks. I mean, we're both from Texas. We know how this is going to work. Yep. We're going to do this. And so why would we not think that's what they're going to do, right?
There's a famous scene in that movie, if you remember, where it's the Cuban and the Russian together.
Yes.
And the Cuban is complaining that I'm a revolutionary, man. I overthrow governments. And now you got me babysitting these people, occupying them. He wanted to be a true commie revolutionary. And here he is, an occupying army, putting down a guerrilla force, which is exactly what the opposite of the business he thought he was in.
It's so funny because I watched that film again for the first time in a long time, about a year ago. And that scene just definitely played different for me now than it did back in the day. I mean,
I gotta tell you, I just watched it recently again, too. And it really is wonderful. I love it. I mean, I've always loved it. I've seen it 100 times or something in my life, including when I was a little kid, watched it over and over again. But watching it now, because it's so funny.
It is.
And it's just the way it's written is just great. It's just it's campy and serious in all the right ways. It's just awesome.
It's a great kind of Cold War artifact. I mean, when you watch it, but it's still fun at the same time. I love that film.
And look, it should be said too here because we skipped it, but the Taliban didn't do 9/11.
That's right.
You know what? This is one of the main reasons that there was such a massive 9/11 truther movement in this country for such a long time was because the government immediately conflated Al-Qaeda with the Taliban. And then, of course, immediately conflated them all with Iraq and Iran and Syria and whoever they could after that, of course, and were in such a hurry to do so. They didn't want people to think this is a war on Al-Qaeda. This is a war on anyone who's also near them. And of course, the Taliban were essentially had been saddled with Al-Qaeda and had inherited them and were stuck with them, but had tried And the CIA admitted this in the Washington Post. The Taliban have been trying to get rid of bin Laden. They hated bin Laden. You know, there's an old saying. You know, I learned who said this and then I forgot it. I got to look it up again. But there's an old saying about the radical becomes conservative the day he seizes the capital city. Well, that had clearly happened to the Taliban. And America had helped, you know, Bill Clinton's government had helped the Taliban come to power in 1996 and seize the capital of Kabul to put an end to the civil war that was being waged by the warlords that Reagan and Bush Sr. had supported before him. And
all buddies. CIA knew all these guys.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and they were all buddies from the old Mujahideen days, at least to some extent, some of them. And I forget if it's which book, because, you know, you read so many of these books on Afghanistan and what went wrong. But they all kind of knew them, and it's like your old high school buddies. You're like, hey, how's it going? And it's just crazy.
That's right. In fact, you know, that's how the first World Trade Center attack happened in 93. Right. Was the State Department tried to keep these guys out of the country, and the CIA intervened and said, no, these guys are friends of ours.
You know? You can't write this stuff. I know.
In fact, when you in my book, you know, I cover Libya and Syria and Iraq and Yemen, and there's a brief mention of the Philippines, and of course the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb out of Algeria. Every one of these groups, every one of what you would call an Al-Qaeda linked type group, even in Somalia, every one of them has their key origin in the 1980s Afghan War that was begun by Jimmy Carter and supported by Ronald Reagan, of course, throughout the 1980s. He even made Rambo 3 about it. Those guys all went home across the Middle East to seed the modern Islamist terrorist movements. And now at the time of September 11th, look, I mean, most of these guys were unemployable and just went to jail or, you know, got menial jobs or, you know, this kind of thing. But there's this small cadre, only 400 guys, essentially a small group of bandits with bin Laden. And the American government wanted to conflate them with everyone else. Oh, and this is what I was saying about the truthers. Was the truthers said, oh, yeah, sure, a bunch of cavemen from the far side of the town of Bedrock from here attacked us because they hate us because of how free we are. That doesn't make any sense. And then you could tell that, boy, they're exploiting the attack to take us to Iraq. So then the conclusion was, well, I guess Dick Cheney did it. But that wasn't what was going on. Bin Laden was the son of a billionaire. The bin Laden family are essentially like, or the bin Laden group, I should say, is essentially like the Kellogg Brown and Root or Halliburton of Saudi Arabia, a massive construction firm that does giant government contracts and things.
They're all Middle East. When I was there in the Navy, I mean, we were in Dubai and Kuwait, I mean, Bahrain.
Probably saw their logo everywhere, right?
Yeah, you see, it's kind of freaky, especially after 9/11. You know, you're kind of like, what the heck is going on here?
Yeah. But so the point is, though, that bin Laden's not a caveman. Bin Laden had an engineering degree.
That's right.
And his partner and right-hand man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, had been a heart surgeon from Cairo. Right? So these are sophisticated guys. They're educated guys. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were not the Taliban. And so, yes, the Bush administration was lying, but not in the way that a lot of people jumped to the conclusion there to believe. And in fact, even after September 11th, the Taliban was willing to negotiate the handover of bin Laden. And Bush said, no negotiations. No negotiations. They said, listen, they said, if you provide some evidence that he did it, we'll turn him over to another Muslim country. Well, first of all, they knew Al-Qaeda did it. They knew Al-Qaeda was going to do something all summer long. And they had all the proof in the world. They all came from the Malaysia meeting and whatever it was. They could have proven that. And Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, said on Meet the Press, yeah, we're writing up a dossier proving that they did it. We're going to give that to the Taliban. Dick Cheney and them canceled all that. No, we're not doing that. And then the Taliban said, okay, if you give us some evidence, we'll turn them over to the Pakistanis. And the Pakistanis scotched that one and said, you know, we don't want him. We can't guarantee his safety. I think the CIA probably put him up to that, but I don't know that. Seems like the Americans probably pressured them to not accept the deal because they were clearly willing to do whatever America said at that point. And then on October the 8th, 2001, the day the bomb started falling, the Taliban said, okay, listen, we don't even need any evidence and we'll turn him over to any country, any third country in the world, which presumably not Israel, but could have been Mexico, could have been Great Britain, could have been, again, even on the first offer, that could have been turn him over to the Jordanians or the Egyptians or the Malaysians or a Muslim country that is, you know, perfectly compliant with American wishes, who would have extradited him to America immediately.
Yep.
Right. And Bush said too little, too late. That was it. And the reason why, the same reason why they conflated Bin Laden with the Taliban, Bin Laden's group, Al-Qaeda, with the Taliban and then with Saddam Hussein and the rest, is because they wanted to wage this global war. They finally had their excuse. Something terrible happened and they could exploit it. And I'll give some credit to the 9/11 truthers that Bush and Cheney might as well have done it. I mean, if you think about the degree of cynicism with which they exploited the deaths of 3,000 Americans, almost entirely civilians.
Yep.
In order to say, oh, you're afraid and angry. Hey, look over here.
Mm-hmm.
And try to fool you and your mom and dad into, you know, directing your bloodlust at people who didn't do it.
Yeah.
Take advantage of the goodwill of the American people who believe that, of course, their president and their defense department are going to protect them, are going to get, as they said, find the guilty, dead or alive, hunt them down, and then it'll be great and we'll be safe again and we'll have gotten our revenge and justice will have been served. And so what they do, they let Bin Laden escape and they took their fight to the Taliban. And they knew that Bin Laden was at Tora Bora. That was where his hideout was, the lion's den. That was where CNN and ABC News and the British Independent and everybody had interviewed him before. It was his hideout from the old days. And they all knew he was there in the Nangarhar province in the White Mountains there. And what'd they do? They spent 8 weeks fighting the Taliban up in Mazar-e Sharif and down in Kandahar, fighting for General Dostum, who had served the communists back in the 80s, and then letting Bin Laden hightail it away. And then when they finally did bring the CIA and Delta Force to Tora Bora, they refused for 3 straight weeks to give them the resupply and the reinforcements that they needed. And they were available. And there are great memoirs by the CIA chief at the time there, Gary Bernson, and the Delta Force chief. I'm sorry?
It's in Jawbreaker.
That's right, Jawbreaker by Gary Bernson. He was the second CIA commander on scene there. And then the other one is called Kill Bin Laden, and it's by the pseudonym is Dalton Fury is the name on the book, but it's Thomas Greer was his real name. He was the Delta Force commander there. And they both complain over and over and over and over again. There were Rangers at Bagram. There were Green Berets in Mazar-e Sharif. There were more Rangers down in Kandahar. And General Mattis had 4,000 marching Marines down there in Kandahar as well. And these guys begged for reinforcements. They're right on the Pakistani border. They can't get reinforcements. They're turned down over and over again. And in fact, Bernson says his commander went and whose name, I'm sorry, is on the tip of my tongue, but is escaping me. But his CIA officer back at Langley went and briefed the president and the vice president, laid a map out on the table and said, this is where we are. This is why we need reinforcements. And we're denied, just straight denied. And we're left to rely on local Afghan militia guys that they didn't even know, who, of course, just took advantage of them and let Bin Laden go. And get this, I'm sorry, I'm still rambling here, but
it's okay.
This, to me, really cinches the case that they deliberately decided to let Bin Laden escape. And I already knew it anyway, and I made the case in both books, but I only just recently read this great article in Task and Purpose, and it's a profile of the single Air Force Special Operations Officer who was embedded there with the Delta Force team. And he was in charge of all air traffic control and including bombing runs. And in fact, he tells the story that during that time, there had been a friendly fire accident somewhere else in the country. And so all aerial bombing was canceled or postponed for 2 weeks while they reviewed their processes or something. And so, but except at Tora Bora. And so this one Air Force commander then had access to every single American airplane in the theater, all of them at his command. He is controlling every bit of their flight paths over his station as he's calling in bombing run after bombing run. And then he says, yep. And then they stopped and we left on December the 8th. December the 8th, but that's only 1 week into the bombing.
Yeah.
They only started bombing at the very, very end of November. So, you know, give it, you know, a week and 2 or 3 days or so, right? But less than 9 days approximately, 10 days maybe. But as famously, bin Laden didn't escape until the 17th. So now you and also your entire audience are familiar with this phrase. It's like a hypnosis thing. It's fun. I don't mean to overstate it, but I like it. I think if Bill Hicks was here, he could get a hoot out of this. That bin Laden and his men slipped across the border into Pakistan. And once that happened, they just evaporated. Once that happened, it was like they had jumped into hyperspace, my lord, and they could be on the far side of the galaxy by now. And there's nothing we can do about it. Or like it's the state line and the county sheriff has to stop and stomp on his hat as the bank robbers get away, you know?
Like an old episode of Dukes of Hazzard or something.
Exactly.
What the heck?
Yeah. The thing of it is that makes no sense at all, right? In other words, the border between Nangarhar province and that part of Western Pakistan, just like all borders in a way, but especially here, is nothing but a figment of your imagination, right? There's nothing marking. There's no road. There's no sign. There's no fence. There's nothing. This is just the wilderness out there. And we're talking about the Army's Delta Force, top tier special operations officers. And they've got Chinooks. They've got weapons.
Yeah.
They can go. And here's the thing. Thomas Greer, again, is his name. Dalton Fury is the pseudonym. He went, and people can look this up right after this interview. Go look him up on 60 Minutes and watch him explain to Scott Pelley. They make a mock-up of the terrain and everything. And he complains, we were going to mine all the valleys. There are, I think, three main valleys out of there that bin Laden and his men had to choose from. We were just going to drop mines in them all, and that would have slowed them down for sure. And once the mines started going off, we'd have found them, and that would have been the end of that. Or their other plan was they were going to take their Chinooks and go over the mountains and then come from the east and head them off at the pass. And in the CIA, another CIA officer, Robert Grenier, he was the station chief in Islamabad. And in his book, he explains that he had arranged with the Pakistani Army and Frontier Corps that when the Delta Force comes chasing Al-Qaeda across the border, when the last stragglers, including bin Laden or not, are trying to escape, we expect Delta Force to come chasing after them on their heels, and the CIA paramilitaries, I should say. And we want to make sure that we don't kill them. So they do what's called deconfliction, right? To make sure that there's communication between the different allied good guys to make sure they don't shoot each other.
Yeah.
And so this was all set up. They were prepared. And then what happened? Of course, George W. Bush, the commander in chief, forbid them from going, canceled their mission, would not allow them. And their excuse was the thinnest thing. Well, we didn't want to rile up some Pakistani tribesmen. I mean, look, I don't want to shoot any Pakistani tribesmen. But you're telling me that that was Dick Cheney and George Bush and Scooter Libby and George Tenet's problem was that they thought, and Donald Rumsfeld's problem was that they thought that a Pakistani tribesman might want to act as a bullet sponge in between the Delta Force and Osama bin Laden. Yeah, I'm sure they were really concerned about that.
Right.
It's
crazy.
And so, and then what did they get out of it? What do they get out of it? It's obvious, right? They told, you know, not to bring your family into it, but that is part of it, right? They weren't just lying to you. They're lying to sort of, I bring up people's mom and dad because to me, it's like a cliche of people who really don't know, but trust what they see on the news. They got regular jobs. They're regular people. They trust the experts, this kind of thing. And so it was your mom and dad. They were trying to make them afraid.
Yep.
That Saddam Hussein would give weapons to Osama bin Laden. Yep. And that whole narrative to use against you in your hometown. And that narrative was dead in the water if bin Laden was dead.
Yep.
And if the American people already considered the war to be over and justice done, and that's what you get for messing with the best, baby, and all of that. And now you're telling us we have to have another war in another place. The narrative was this is the same war, just a different part of it. Against the terrorism. And that was it. And that was why they did it. And in fact, one more major piece of evidence here. I'll encourage people to read the Bob Woodward book, Bush at War, where Bush just told the National Security Council people, you know, staffers, give all the papers to Bob. We like Bob. And they gave him, you know, much of everything. And so he has block quotes of these people talking, Donald Rumsfeld and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz, all of them discussing on the Principals Committee of the National Security Council. Well, we don't want to define the war too narrowly as against Al-Qaeda. And if we do kill bin Laden, we don't want to call that a victory. And if we don't kill bin Laden, we don't want to call that a failure. And if we want to make sure, gee, boss, do you think maybe we should start bombing Baghdad right now? Just so the American people understand that this is a war that's going to take place in a wide geographical area and over an extended period of time. And all this is their discussions within the very first days. And it even got to the point where Cheney shushed Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld about Iraq. Cheney himself said, we've heard enough from you two about Iraq. We'll do Iraq in a minute, but we're doing Afghanistan now, and that's what we're discussing right now, so it's time for you to be quiet. Bush, and I guess Bush had Andrew Carr, the chief of staff, shush them, and then Cheney himself. Imagine Dick Cheney telling Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, you already said Iraq like 16 times this morning. Be quiet now. Right? Like, these people are bananas. And that's they're worse than bananas. It's not the right thing to say. I mean, it is. That's true, right? Like their will to what they wanted to do, as detached as it was from what the crisis really was and what should have been done about it, is just a chasm. Like, it's impossible, like the Pacific Ocean. It's impossible to believe that they would say, now's our chance to go hit secular Saddam Hussein with his clean shaven chin. Right when they should have been sending Rumsfeld back over there to shake hands with him again and bring him back in from the cold on one condition, two conditions. Keep Al-Qaeda down, no massacres, right?
Yep, and they probably could have done that.
Absolutely, they could have done that. In fact, that's in the book, in Enough Already. There are two different major stories, one by James Risen and one by Seymour Hersh, where Saddam sent emissaries, third-party emissaries, to do back channel negotiations with Richard Perle, who is absolutely one of the very worst neoconservative ringleaders of the plot to get us into that war. So I guess it sort of made sense that they would want to talk to him, but boy, also it didn't make sense that they would want to talk to him.
Yeah.
They didn't get anywhere with it. But according to those emissaries' side of the story anyway, Saddam offered everything. He said, you know, he didn't even know. It goes to show how innocent he was at the time. He didn't even know what the war was about. He said, if this is about oil, you guys, I'll sign you up. American companies can develop all the oil. If this is about terrorism, well, I'll work with you on killing Al-Qaeda guys. That's fine with me. I hate and fear those guys just like you do. And if this is about democracy, I'll hold elections under international inspection. And if this is about weapons of mass destruction, you can send in the FBI and the army to traipse around with the UN weapons inspectors and look, there's nothing. Nothing that wasn't already declared and sitting under lock and seal somewhere or rotten out in the desert somewhere, but declared and open and left over from the 80s when he was still our ally. And Richard Perle told him, tell Saddam, we'll see you in Baghdad. In other words, unconditional surrender. Oh, and I'm sorry, I left out one. If you want us to switch sides in the Israel-Palestine conflict, no problem. We'll put pressure on Hamas to do whatever you say. And they said, unconditional surrender, not going to cut it.
Hey guys, are you enjoying this episode on history and economics? Are you looking to take your learning to the next level? Well, the next level of the American History Podcast can be found at Liberty Classroom. This site is awesome, and it's perfect for parents who have homeschool kids or even adults who are simply lifelong learners. Go to theamericanhistorypodcast.com, click on the linked picture on the sidebar, and you'll be ready to join. You'll find courses on, of course, history, but also economics, Latin American history, literature, rhetoric, and more, all of which are taught by fantastic professors I know and trust, people like Tom Woods, graduate of both Harvard and Columbia, as well as others like Robert Murphy, Kevin Gutzman, Brian McClanahan, Jeffrey Herbner, and many other great scholars. Seriously, this is a fantastic site. If you're looking to finally learn the things they didn't teach in high school, but should have, unless I was your teacher, of course, this is the place for you. Again, be sure to enter the site via the link on our website, and we'll get a small finder's fee. It's a win-win for you and the show. Now back to the program.
Every time I think about these, that time period, well, even going forward, it does my head in. Let's pause here for a moment of from our sponsors. Okay, now I've got a new question. We talked about the Taliban a little bit, and I'm interested in them and Russia and China and Pakistan, and kind of clear that up a little bit, because I think people forget that, you know, Russia was involved in that. And we hear a lot about Russia right now. They're the big boogeyman, if you believe that, which obviously I know you don't. But, you know, we had that Taliban insurgency going on and after the initial invasion and then Obama and all that stuff. So supposedly the Russians were helping them and China and Pakistan. I mean, what was going on with all that?
Oh, man. Well, that's just a lie. Well, it's 99% a lie.
Try to boil it down, I guess. Because I'm interested in Russia was fairly supportive of the so-called war on terrorism from the start, at least.
Absolutely. They supported the same government America stalled in power the entire time. The only reason they started talking to the Taliban was the same reason America started talking to the Taliban. We're leaving, and we really want you guys to shake hands on a deal that you'll keep radical international terrorist movements down and out, which, again, the Taliban are not.
Yeah.
You know, this is why, remember when they rolled into Kabul, they just walked right into Kabul and said, we're the police force now, right? Mm-hmm. People were expecting and they were reacting emotionally as though it was ISIS had come to town. Yes. When ISIS, you know, remember when they took over Western Iraq, it was just a slaughter. They just mass murdered people everywhere and threw gays off rooftops and set things on fire. And it was Patrick Coburn called them the Islamist Khmer Rouge. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's not the Taliban.
No.
You know, people were kind of afraid of that. But the deal is the Taliban like killing ISIS and they, I don't know if they like killing Al-Qaeda, but there aren't really any Al-Qaeda around for them to kill anyway.
Yeah.
And toward the end of the war there, and you can read this in the Washington Post, that back to the Delta Force, top tier special operations officers, JSOC, were working with the Taliban to fight ISIS in a little mini awakening type movement where, sorry for fighting you this whole time. Turns out you guys are just the indigenous local militia types. We can work with you to kill these transnational suicide bomber types. And the Taliban took them up on the deal. So the Americans were flying drones as air cover for the Taliban fighting ISIS on the ground there. ISIS, which, by the way, the CIA had a hand in helping to create. And which, by the way, Obama's war in Pakistan had a hand in helping to create a step before that. But so the Russians starting, I think, I don't know what year is it now, 22, starting about probably 4 or 5 years ago, even said to the Taliban, hey, we'll supply you with some guns and money if you promise to stay cool with us. And who, after all, the Russians are not the Soviet Union anymore.
Yeah.
You promise to stay cool with us and you promise to stay as a buffer between us and these ISIS guys. And we'll begin to establish a relationship here. Well, that's the exact same thing that the Obama and then Trump government was doing, too. And at the same time, they were bombing them. They were also working with them, you know, in limited ways. Now, what you're kind and I'll get back to Iran and Pakistan in a sec, because you mentioned that. But your real implication here, what you're referring to, is the story from the summer of 2020 by Charlie Savage in The New York Times.
Yes.
Blaring this absolute ridiculous CIA propaganda that the Russians were paying for dead American scalps, putting bounties, will pay you per dead American you kill. Well, here's the thing about that. People knew immediately that wasn't right, because every time an American is killed in Afghanistan, there's an official investigation. Yeah. And the military is not covering that up. It's just that's not what happened in any circumstance. And the story was obviously a lie. And the New York Times began adding all of these qualifiers and disclaimers. And I quote in my book, I got in a big fight over the email with Charlie Savage, the author myself, where he defended the story by saying, listen, I'm paraphrasing, but this is his case.
Yeah.
I reported the fact that there is this wild, obviously false rumor going around. And that is a fact. And so the fact then that people read that on the above the fold, the top page of the most important newspaper in the world, just because that meant that every Democrat and every national security state official and every TV news talking head took that to mean the CIA says that the Russians have been doing this and that there's any credible reason whatsoever to believe that that's true. Well, that's just your fault if you interpreted it that way. All I did was report on the fact that there's a rumor going around. Now, then when it came to the rumor, it was completely preposterous and no motive whatsoever in the world to do that. And then all of the top national security state officials backed down from it. The general in charge of the war, the commander of CENTCOM, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the secretary of defense, and I forget if the head of the CIA, too, also said that we got nothing here. The NSA made it be known immediately that they didn't believe that that was true. And, of course, they're the ones who track every one and zero on the planet.
Yeah.
They know who's paying who. And who's not and why. And then, so the whole thing was a farce. It was a farce. But is that the way the American people remember it?
Nope.
That story completely blew up and fell apart and exploded in disgrace and that the reporters all had to go get jobs washing dishes after that? No. That story, it stuck anyway. Mm-hmm. And they climbed down from it, but not in a way that mattered to the public. That prevented Trump from withdrawing the troops last summer, which, summer before last, which I'm not certain he would have done anyway, but there was a trial balloon or two like that. And he was talking with the Pentagon about pursuing that, and they were trying to thwart it. And so that was what they did. They came up with this ridiculous story. Savage even said to me, yeah, but the story comes from Afghan police originally. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, that makes it way more credible. These people have every incentive in the world to come up with an excuse to get us to stay, to save their bacon. You know, oh, sure. They just tortured some lie out of some bum. If they even bothered with that, if they didn't just make up the whole thing out of whole cloth.
That's right.
You know, now, as far as the Pakistanis backing the Afghan Taliban, absolutely true. The whole time, basically, since at least 2004, 2005. And there's an extremely important reason for that. It's the same reason the Taliban helped put them in power, helped Bill Clinton. He helped them put the Taliban in power back in the mid 1990s. The Pakistanis, as you know, have this major strategic rivalry with their neighbors to the southeast, India. Mm-hmm. And in the event of a nuclear war, the Pakistanis' idea is that Afghanistan is their strategic depth. They need to be able to control, if they have to, control Afghanistan, essentially annex it, move into it, get out of the way of exploding A-bombs by retreating across the Khyber Pass. And they can't do that reliably. You know, they can't have a reliable plan to be able to do that if Afghanistan is in the hands of friends of the Indians. So who's that? That's the Tajiks and the Uzbeks, primarily among the three groups that I mentioned earlier, including the Hazaras, that the Americans supported in power there. And so, of course, the more the Indians intervened to help support the government and ally with the government there, the more the Pakistanis would supply the Afghan Taliban. And the more the Afghan Taliban would fight the Americans with that support, the more the Americans under W. Bush, Obama, and into Trump as well, would turn to the Indians for more support. Back at one point, and this went around and around like this for 15 years. I mean, mm-hmm. No kidding. And at one point, the Americans have all these sanctions on Russia, so they had to use the Indians as a cutout to buy a bunch of helicopters from the Russians to give to the Afghan National Air Force there. And remember now, the Pakistanis are our allies too. I mean, I'm not saying they're our loyal friends, but they're inside the American fold here. But there was nothing the Americans could do to prevent them from pursuing this. And then my best understanding of the situation, which I knew about this being true to a degree, you know, I think as soon as it was on early in the war, but from what I understand, the Americans in charge, the military guys, refused to accept that this was a truth until about 2007 or, you know, late in 2007 into 2008. And still, they didn't know what to do about it. So all they could do was ask the Indians for more help, please, and just make matters worse. And but they seemed to not even want to recognize the fact of what was going on there and what motive the Pakistanis would have to do that. But essentially, that was the position that we put them in. So what were they going to do? Exactly that.
Yeah.
Now, as far as Iran, they go back in the category with Russia and, again, America, too, for that matter, that, well, I guess we have to deal with the Taliban because who else do we have to deal with? they rule the entire south of the country, and now, of course, the whole country. But for years, they have ruled the entire countryside, essentially everything but the provincial provinces in about, you know, probably 70% of or more, 75% of the landmass of the country, everything but the far north. And then, of course, they took the far north in just a few weeks this summer. Once they moved on it, it was a piece of cake. But they had already controlled so much of the country for years and years. So, of course, the Iranians had to deal with them. Yeah. They don't have any love for them. Guess who the Iranians have been backing in power the last 20 years? Our same friends, the coalition of the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and the Hazaras, who are Shiites, like the Iranians, and maintain a very close relationship there. And so I guess in one universe right now, America has allied again with the Ayatollah to support the Hazaras against the Taliban. Although I guess we'll see which side. Yeah, the Americans, I think the CIA themselves sometimes can't keep track of who they're stabbing in the back and supporting now.
You got to have a program to keep up with this. It's insane. Wait, I mean, like I said earlier, you couldn't write this as a fiction. The truth is stranger than fiction in this case. It's crazy. Yeah.
And look, the only reason I was able to write it was because I stayed home. If I'd been a soldier in the war, or a journalist in the war, I'd have missed most of this.
Yeah.
You know, but I stayed home, but I covered it all along. And I had the correct, doubtful, cynical take on it all along. And so was why I was able to sit when I went to sit down and write the book. I already knew how it went.
Yeah.
I had to fill in some details, do a lot more research, of course, to fill it all out. But as far as what's going on here, you probably had to have been paying attention the whole time to have kept up, you know, to see how it shook out. But
crazy.
It is. Yeah. It's a tragedy. And that's the thing of it is that if you could somehow measure the amount of grief and suffering these people have been through for nothing this whole time.
Yep.
When they could have just left Mullah Omar in power in Kabul. Look here, you Mullah Omar, turn over your Arabs. And that's all they had to do. You know what? One more anecdote from Gary Bernson's book, Jawbreaker, that you mentioned there. There's a scene in that book where he's on the radio, CIA commander with a few militia guys and some air power.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on the radio with a Taliban, you know, army commander. You know, this guy's got a brigade or whatever in a sort of a more of a state style formation that the Taliban had been creating at that time, building a real army.
Mm-hmm.
And Bernson says to him, oh, and the guy wants to surrender because the American planes are just obliterating these formations of men, you know, just personnel that's getting wiped out by B-52s and whatever. So this guy wants to surrender. And Bernson says to him, do you have any Arabs? And he says, yes, I have about 20. And Bernson says, kill them. And he says, all right, hang on just one second. And then Bernson hears rat, tat, 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 tat in the background. And then the guy gets back on the phone and says, all right, the Arabs are dead. Can we surrender now? And he says, yep, welcome. So in other words, in that moment of crisis, boy, were the Taliban willing to negotiate with us.
Yep.
You know, and we did have the biggest gun in the world to their head. It's true. They were already carpet bombing the hell out of them. But at that point, they were compliant. And the Americans might not know the difference between an Egyptian and a Pashtun, but the Pashtuns do.
Yeah.
And a bunch of Egyptians from 1,500 miles away, getting them into a lot of serious trouble with the world's only superpower, was kind of would tend to cause resentment, you might imagine. And had already been the case and was even more so at that time. And if you think about that scene, if you could believe Gary Bernson's take on that, it seemed credible to me when I read it.
Yeah. Yeah. The moment you said that, I remembered that scene in the book and just thinking, Jesus, you know, I don't even know. It's crazy.
Moral of the story is, though, even if you say, forget negotiating, we wanted those Al-Qaeda guys bombed. Still, you didn't have to overthrow the government in Kabul.
That's right.
You could have just focused on killing the Al-Qaeda guys. And honestly, really, and this is some what Gary Bernson said and General Zinni, who had been the former commander of Central Command, they both agreed in 2016 that, you know, essentially in brackets, the boys at antiwar.com were right. This war could have been over by Christmas 2001. We didn't have to have a 21st century of war at all. And the troops know it too. The guys who've been to Iraq and Afghanistan and back, they tell the pollsters now that they think those wars should have never happened at all in higher percentages than the general population.
Yep. Yep. Insane.
It's the greatest betrayal. I mean, we're talking, even if we're just sticking with Afghanistan, we're talking about a few hundred thousand killed. That people bombed to smithereens too. You think about how sad you were when your auntie died of natural causes.
Yeah.
Imagine somebody blew her to little bitty pieces.
Yep.
How you feel about that?
Yeah.
And we did that to tens and tens and tens and tens of thousands of people for a generation straight.
Yep. How many weddings did we hear about that were drone attacked?
At least a dozen. Solid dozen. Tom Englehart counted them at tomdispatch.com, and I quote him. I have a block quote in the first book, Fool's Errand, where he catalogs the different drone strikes. That doesn't include Yemen. It's just in Afghanistan.
So real quick here, we still got about 10 minutes or so. Let's briefly talk about what's happened since August. How does Afghanistan look? Because I remember sitting there when Kabul was falling, and then in the immediate aftermath, oh my God, it's going to be the worst thing ever. You know, dogs and cats are going to be sleeping together, whatever the heck these media types were saying. It was going to be, you know, hell on earth. How does Afghanistan look right now?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, the first thing is, I guess on the positive side, I can say there has not been wholesale massacres. There has not been, again, like when ISIS took over Western Iraq in 2014. Thanks, Obama. It hasn't been like that.
Okay.
Now, there have been reports of revenge killings. They had promised amnesty for anybody who would surrender and stay home and get along, and their former government security official give up their guns. But there are reports of revenge killings. There are a lot of hard feelings in this country.
Yeah.
This war has been going on for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, it is not the world's greatest nightmare in terms of, you know, like when the commies took over in Cambodia or something like that. It's not like that. However, it's a desperately poor country. It always was. Another, of course, you know, set of the major promises about this war was how we were rebuilding or even building in the first place an Afghan infrastructure and economic society. We're going to build a hydroelectric dam in the Helmand province, and we've got these massive, you know, diesel generator plants going on in Kandahar. We have this huge new power plant project going up near Kabul. We're building or improving, rebuilding the giant highway from the old communist days that does the big loop around the country. And we're building all these schools and all these office parks and all these things to, you know, generate business. Well, they never did develop an Afghan economy. Oh, all the agriculture projects. Mm-hmm. They never did anything but develop an opium economy, even worse than they were already dependent on. It's essentially the, you know, virtually the entire economy of Afghanistan is dependent on poppies.
Yeah.
Yet the international so-called community won't just legalize it and let them try to sell it as medicine on the open market. Instead, it has to be this thing where, again, innocent people are caught up in the trade and then caught up in the consequences of that, when it shouldn't have to be whatsoever.
Yep.
Anyway, that's what they did in Turkey. Remember Turkish heroin?
Oh, well,
they
yep.
just legalized it. Now they your doctor gives it to you at the, you know, office.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so but they didn't help grow a new turmeric industry and a new cumin industry there like they said they were going to. They didn't accomplish any of those things. The State Department, USAID, they accomplished nothing when it nothing permanent when it yeah. comes to any of that. So then, you know, it's really just like the stock market bubble, right? The Federal Reserve is constantly pouring liquid money into the pockets of the owners of the companies, and which they use to speculate on buying more stock and bid up the price of the stock. Not that the value of the company has actually really increased. Yeah. Same thing here. The Austrian business cycle theory for sock puppet governments in foreign nations.
Yep.
We're propping up all this power and a some sectors of the economy with all this funny money inflated by the Fed, taxed and stolen from the American people and funneled into this economy. Now, the vast majority of it, of course, goes to foreign NGOs who take that money right back out of the country again, or, you know, corrupt government leaders who go and secret it away in accounts in Dubai or whatever it is. But yeah, some of that money's getting into the economy there. Some of that wealth is helping to grease the skids of the actual providing of goods and services to people. And then what happens when you just shut that all off immediately? You have a Great Depression.
Yep.
You have a massive crash. And so the massive devaluing of the money, meaning, you know, massive increase in prices of everything. And, you know, that can only go so far, especially in a country that's as poor and with as undeveloped economy as it has. That can only happen, can go so far before the markets just freeze up, you know, and things, goods and services aren't getting distributed at all.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, the government is the Taliban, who have been militia fighters for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
It's true that they've had, you know, civil and criminal court systems essentially as a shadow government in much of the country for a while. But truly running infrastructure and having some taxes so they can pay for security on the roads, but not so much taxes that nobody's willing to travel the roads to transfer goods and services places and all these things. They don't know how to do that. They're a bunch of hillbillies from the far side of Pashtunistan from here, man. They don't know anything about being a state or how to do this right at all. And so, you know, will they be able to strike a deal with the Uzbeks to keep the lights on? Because they're importing electricity from across international borders here. We're talking most rudimentary questions on, you know, for them to be able to handle in terms of just staying going at all. And then you have the Americans, the world's worst sore losers. I guess they're lucky we didn't drop an atom bomb on them on the way out the door. But Joe Biden's keeping sanctions on the Taliban, and they're withholding money that belongs to the sovereign government of Afghanistan, which now happens to be the Taliban, since, you know, they won the war and we lost it. But instead of saying, okay, well, I hope you don't spend all this money. I hope you don't spend all this money killing ISIS, but instead buy some wheat for your people or something and giving them the money. The Biden government won't give them the money and is keeping the sanctions on them. And I just read, I think it was yesterday, there was a headline on antiwar.com where the Treasury has decided to loosen up restrictions on aid, humanitarian aid to Afghanistan a little bit.
Yeah.
What? You know, and people got to understand that other than the U.S. military itself or the CIA, maybe, probably more than the CIA, the U.S. Treasury is the most dangerous force on the planet. If you're some kind of international businessman of any import whatsoever, you do not mess with the U.S. Treasury Department.
Yeah.
They can absolutely destroy you. They can dictate to the entire world whether you can trade between Zimbabwe and Central African Republic. I mean, they will do whatever they want. And so if they say you can provide humanitarian aid to Afghanistan, then you can. You probably better double check then too, make sure that they said it was okay, even for you. And you see what happens in Iran, for example, where they can't get medicine. And it's not because we have an embargo on medicine, but it's just because no international shipper wants to go to Iran. And that means no medicine. You know, so this is how we do business. This is how we treat them. And look, I mean, they whooped us fair in a fight. Yep. So don't we have to like shake hands and respect them now? Isn't that the rules? That we have to at least respect them for whooping us in a fight and at least give them what we stole from them back?
That's kind of the way you and I grew up, but I guess the way we grew up isn't the way the U.S. government grew up, right?
It is. It's really ugly. It is ugly. You know, and I'm sorry, in just the last couple minutes here, let me mention too that the worst thing going on in the entire world right now, it ain't the Uyghurs in Western China. In fact, if anything, look out for the CIA backing them again. But the worst thing happening in the entire world today is the American, Saudi, UAE, and AQAP war in Yemen against this group called the Houthis that seized power now 7 years ago. In fact, 7 years ago right now, America was allied with the Houthis for a very brief time because they like killing Al-Qaeda guys. And you can read two important pieces of journalism in January 2015. One in the Wall Street Journal and one in Al Monitor. That one's by Barbara Slavin. I forgot who wrote the journal piece. Very easy to find, though. One in the Journal, one by Slavin in Al Monitor, both about how America's now working with the Houthis, passing them intelligence to use to target and kill Al-Qaeda guys. Why? Because the Al-Qaeda guys think that if you're a Shiite, then you're better off dead. And they would rather kill them all. And so does America have any real problem with the Houthis? Did they knock down our towers? Are they even really the sock puppets of Iran, like in the claims? And did Iran knock down our towers? No, 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 no. Al-Qaeda. Right. Those are AQAP are the guys who bombed the coal. They're the guys who helped coordinate this September 11th attack. They tried to blow up a plane with the underpants bomb over Detroit on Christmas Day 2009. They did the Charlie Hebdo attack and one or two of the other massacres in Europe. You know, those weren't all just ISIS. Those were AQAP attacks. And there was two failed printer cartridge bomb plots attempting to blow up planes as well. That's who these guys are. They're the enemies of the American people. Not again, of course, they're descendants of those who came home from the Afghan War in the 1980s, as we discussed. Mm-hmm. But they're the ones who ever did anything to us. And so Obama's government, in fact, our current Secretary of Defense under Joe Biden, Lloyd Austin, was then the commander of Central Command, four-star general. And he was the one in charge of this policy. He was the one doing this. But then 2 months later, in March of 2015, Obama turned around and took Saudi, UAE, and Al-Qaeda's side against the Houthis. And that's the war, not the war on terrorism, but the war directly on behalf of Al-Qaeda is the war that we've been fighting in Yemen for the last 7 years. And, you know, it's one of these ridiculous so-called deniable operations where it's not even deniable. It's not like it's a secret or a clandestine thing as much as they just have a turn of phrase. They got some public relations sleight of hand going on. We're leading from behind. This is the Saudi-led coalition. And the Saudi-led coalition is doing this and doing that. Except that you and I and everyone listening knows USA is the world's superpower.
Yep.
They are our client state. They're flying our F-15s, dropping our Lockheed and Raytheon and Northrop Grumman bomb or Boeing brand bombs on these people's heads. And they're using American intelligence to pick all their targets, American mercenaries and Air Force officers to take care of all their logistics for, you know, organizing the air campaign. And we got British special operations on the ground and the maintenance for all their weapons and planes, I should say. And the British and French are taking part, too. The British sell them their Typhoon planes and their special boat services and special air services are on the ground training mercenaries, including child soldiers, again, embedded with Al-Qaeda on the ground fighting on their side. And the thing of it is, because it's the so-called Saudi-led war, the Americans have this deniable position on the targeting and the way it's being done. Sure, we're helping them with the targeting, but it's the Saudi-led coalition. Yeah. So now the Americans, they wage brutal air wars. I'm not trying to whitewash the air wars, especially you look at like the way they did Iraq War III, the ISIS war in Iraq and Syria in 2014 through 17. It's pretty wide scale destruction, but I don't think it is a direct comparison to the way the Americans have helped the Saudis, as they say, to directly and deliberately target the waterworks, the electricity, the sewage, the hospitals, the markets, the trucks, the farms, the horses in their stables and the flocks of sheep in their fields and the fishermen in their boats and everything. And just doing everything they can, the irrigation systems, everything they can to starve and destroy the civilian population of the country. America, you know, for all the talk of shock and awe, that's not the way they waged Iraq War II.
No.
And it's I mean, in Afghanistan, there wasn't that much to bomb in the first place. Not that Yemen is much wealthier of a country than that, but this has been, I'm sorry if I'm rambling, but the point being that there are officially 250,000 people have been killed, but it's got to be more than 500,000.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to bet you that when the war is finally over, if it ever ends, and they send the people in to do the excess death rates, that you'll find that more than 1 million people have been killed or deprived to death in this war. And that's mostly, you know, there's been these massive cholera outbreaks and just children dying of malnutrition and easily treatable diseases in any other circumstances. But because they're so poor and sick and weak, then a common cold comes by and knocks them dead, this kind of thing. And it's just, it's the most medieval damn thing in the world. It's absolutely, it's as bad as anything the Americans have accused any of their enemies of in 50 years.
Yep.
You know, it's, speaking of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, that's what it is. It's as brutal as that.
Yeah, it
is.
It's
as heinous as that. You know, it's just, it's as, it's every bit as bad as Iraq War II, even though with 1,000th the attention paid to what's happening there.
Well, we're up against our time limit, Scott. Thank you so much for coming back on. I appreciate it. I always love listening to your show, and getting you on is a special treat. So thank you very much
for having me. Happy New Year.
Yep. Happy New Year, Scott. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
All right. So that's all for today. That was our discussion with the great Scott Horton. I hope you enjoyed it. I know it was a little longer than our usual episodes, but we try to give you a good show here. So hopefully you did enjoy it. Obviously, if you're enjoying what you're hearing, please feel free to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. It really does help people find the show. And if you'd like more content that's not available to the general public, check out our Patreon, where for $10 a month, you can get access to quite a bit of content, somewhere over 20 hours by now, I'm pretty sure, although I haven't counted lately, so, but it's quite a bit. All right, so I'm your host, Sean, and this was the American History Podcast. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.